Welcome to another exciting episode of Deterrence Down Under, a podcast dedicated to Australia and the challenges of deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region. Deterrence Down Under is part of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies podcasting network, where we strive to promote peace, foster strategic stability, and help you to think deterrence. Just a friendly reminder that the opinions expressed by our hosts and guests are their own and don't necessarily reflect any institution with which they may be affiliated. G'day from Canberra. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Hi, and welcome to Deterrence Down Under. I'm your host, Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
Today we've got a really great special guest. We've got Melvin Deal here. And he's an associate professor at the Air Command and Staff College in the U.S. Dr. Deal is a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. He's got a Ph.D. in American history from UNC Chapel Hill. He flew the B-52 Stratofortress and the B-2 Spirit. He's flown combat operations as part of Desert Storm, Enduring Freedom, and he's even flown a 44.3-hour combat mission, which I'm sure, is it like a marathon where like the last 0.3 was the hardest part? he's a recipient of the Distinguished Firing Cross and also a distinguished graduate of the USAF Weapons School. We're going to get to Dr. Deal's thoughts in just a second, but first, some deterrence news from Australia. Natalie.
In deterrence news, we had USS Minnesota, a Virginia-class nuclear-powered fast attack submarine arrived in Western Australia in late February. It was the first of two US planned visits to HMS Stirling in 2025. The port visit supports the first pillar of Australia, United Kingdom and the United States Trilateral Security Agreement, AUKUS. Commander Jeffrey Corniel, the commanding officer of USS Minnesota, stated that the US would honour its commitment to supply a nuclear-powered submarine to Australia. He also mentioned that progress is being made on that front, and this statement was aimed at reassuring the Australian government and public since fears had set in over the arrangement. In other news, we had the Australia's Chief of Air Force, Air Marshal Stephen Chappell, confirm the RAF's new MQ TAC-4C Triton unmanned aircraft system that arrived from the United States last year was not ready to contribute to the Australian Defence Force's monitoring of the Chinese task force. However, Air Marshal Chappell was very comfortable with the Australian military response to Chinese warships. He went on to describe our strategic circumstances as a period of strategic autumn, and that the Air Force's job with the rest of the ADF, defence colleagues, interagency colleagues, and with allies and partners in industry is to ultimately deter in the minds of those who make decisions, those decisions that would push us from autumn into winter.
Maybe we could start with a brief overview of the School of Advanced Nuclear Deterrence Studies, or SANS, along with its history and mission and how you carry that out there.
Okay. So the School of Advanced Nuclear Deterrence Studies is a seminar of roughly 13 people from selected across the nuclear enterprise. The school was started in 2015. General Wilson, then the head of Air Force Global Strike Command, wanted a program dedicated to producing deterrence-minded individuals who could think at the strategic level. For the first 3 years, the school was run out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. In 2017, General Rand, for a number of reasons, but that was General Rand's decision, he decided to move the school from Albuquerque under Air Command and Staff College out at Maxwell Air Force Base. And the dean at the time, Dr. Forsyth, came to me and said, hey, if you had a School of Advanced Nuclear Deterrence Studies, what would it look like? And so put together a faculty of myself, Dr. Todd Robinson, Dr. Kate Bolefeld are the two civilian permanent professors with myself. And then we have two rotating military people, usually somebody from the missileer community, somebody from the bomber community. The seminar itself is nine selected, hand-picked Air Force people from across the nuclear enterprise. Typically, about a third are in the bomber community, a third are in the missileer community, and then the other third are typically You can have a cyber expert, NC3. You can have force protection, a 31 Papa, or maintenance, aircraft or missile maintenance, or munitions maintenance. Then we also have a slot for a Navy person. Typically, it'll be someone who's on a boomer. Then we have a slot for an Army sister service person, either an FA-52 or EOD. It's historically been an explosive ordnance person. And then we have one civilian person, usually within the enterprise. And then the last slot, we keep aside for an international officer. In the history of SANS, we've had three international officers. We'd like to have more. This year, we do have a student with us from the Netherlands. The students take about 70% of the core ACSC academics, but then they also take two specialized core classes in deterrence and two electives. One elective looks at nuclear planning and operations and issues with the stockpile. And then the second elective is every graduate student does an independent research project, a thesis, if you will, typically about 20 to 25 pages. We just don't want to be in the classroom. We want the students to have some experiential learning. So we get them out of the classroom. We typically take about 5 to 6 trips a year. We'll go to the STRATCOM Deterrent Symposium, and while we're at STRATCOM, kind of get them the operational plans. This year, they got to sit down with General Cotton, get his views at the strategic level. We go to Global Strike Command, have them learn about where the programs of record are in terms of, right, what's on time, what's sliding to the right, how are things looking, what's the budget look like. Then we go out and see how we maintain the stockpile. So we'll go to N2S2, which is up in Nevada, to learn how they verify the stockpile at that site. We go to Kings Bay because it's a short hop and a jump from where Maxwell is, about 5-6 hour drive over to Kings Bay. So they can learn how the other leg of the triad. Most of them come to us knowing how the Air Force operates triad. We go take them to learn how the third leg of the triad operates from the Navy's perspective. This year we did Y-12 as well, which is about 3.5 hours from us. So that's a nice jump. And then the last trip of the year, which we just got back from, is we do a European trip. We always start out by going to the Ministry of Defense, which is our UK allies, to understand their deterrence policy, understand where they're at. We go to NATO in Brussels. We go to SHAPE in Brussels. NATO to get the strategic idea of what's being done at the policy level, how's NATO policy being formed, and then SHAPE to say how is it being implemented. And then lastly, this year, because we had a student with us from the Netherlands, we went, we did a trek up towards Amsterdam, went through Volkel, Air Force Base, then went up to The Hague, which is where the Netherlands Ministry of Defense is, their Department of Defense. And then we've ended up in Amsterdam. So, and that's kind of how the program runs. It's been going for a decade. We'll graduate our 10th class here shortly.
Wow, that's a lot of travel. And it sounds like a lot of learning packed into a short amount of time there. So you're producing really deterrence-minded strategists, it sounds like, as part of this program. And what jobs would you hope that these people go on to, you know, that you're preparing them with all this great knowledge? Where do you hope they go in the future?
So I will say that most of the people that come to us from what I would say are the maintenance or the force protection track in the nuclear enterprise typically leave us and go directly to command. Because that's what their community wants. We do keep one of the graduates behind, sort of a first assignment IP kind of thing. They stay on faculty because they know the curriculum and they can help teach the next class. And then I would say from the rest, if you had to pin me down, a majority will go to STRATCOM. So we'd send. So just as an example, right? So this year, we'll send about 2 or 3 to STRATCOM. In previous classes, we've sent as many as 4 to STRATCOM. We have about right now about 8 graduates at STRATCOM. Obviously, we send some to Global Strike Command. Ultimately, right, we want these individuals who go to the staff that then go on to enter some kind of a command track to be a director of operations and then eventually be a squadron commander, and then we'll see where they go from there. Currently, we have several, I would say, of the SANS classes that I have helped graduate. We have several that are leaving command this summer, going on to that NDU SDE experience, and then hopefully even bigger and better things after that. But that's kind of where, if I look out and say, okay, of the classes that I've helped produce, where are they right now? Most of them, fourth class on, are and exiting squadron command, moving on to SDE. So, and what we would hope is, right, they hit the next rank and they go on to be group commanders and even further.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That sounds like a great career pathway and a great jumpstart to any career is to enter this program. You mentioned that they write a thesis. You know, what are some of the topics that are timely and people are working on today? Obviously, there's a lot changing in deterrence in the nuclear world.
So I would say if you looked across our students, we have several that are writing about, let's talk about policy. So a little bit. And I got to preface this by, again, doing the disclaimer that anything I say here is, right, my view and doesn't represent the Department of Defense, Air Force, or Air University. So from a policy perspective, we used to have under the previous couple administrations ago, we had this idea of a 3+2 policy. Is that's how many weapons we were going to have. We're going to have three weapons that were going to go on missiles, two that were going to be air delivered. And that was the limit of the stockpile. Obviously, the world has changed since that NPR to where you have now, if you look at the 2023 strategic posture review, we're now living in a world where we're looking at adding more capability to the arsenal. And so we have students writing about Slick Command. What will Slick Command look like? Or what should it be? Where should it be deployed? How should it be deployed? We have students looking at research efforts in your AOR, looking at should we have a Indo-PACOM NATO-like setup. Okay, so we have students looking at that. One of our students who was at the STRATCOM symposium won an award for his ideas about DCA and South Korea for the paper that he wrote for CSIS. We also have students looking at the idea of assurance. So I would say, yes, there are nations out there that have said, come put them on our soil. Okay. We would love to host the DCA mission. I don't know that there's an appetite for expanding the DCA mission, but if I give you missile defense, for example, if I put a missile defense site on your nation, or if I put missile defense on your territory, does that assure you without having to actually give you a host nation status, right? So those are some of the research topics the students are looking at. And then they take the second semester to refine their research and produce published paper. And then they'll outbrief their papers. And then we've been very successful with getting the papers published either as independent papers through Air University or in more reputable journals, as a matter of fact. So the students do good work there. I think we start off the year, like I said, why do we take them on those initial trips to STRATCOM or even to Global Strike or to the Deterrent Symposium? Because they get to hear the discussions that are going on out there in the community, and they can kind of figure out, that's something that I want to investigate or something I want to research. So starting them off the Deterrent Symposium helps them understand what the current research efforts are, where people are thinking, and maybe give them a vector from there.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, really great opportunity for them to learn more. And They probably learned quite a bit on this recent trip to Europe. I mean, with everything changing there, you know, maybe you could give us some of your thoughts on what you heard from some of the allies and NATO and how they're feeling about extended nuclear deterrence these days, given everything that's changing.
So I would say, this is what I would say. A lot of what when we talk to the allies, we kind of are in receive mode. We'll ask them questions. Obviously, we're not there as policymakers. We're there to learn what their views are like. What I would say is you have to, one of the things that the United States does, which is what other nations that have nuclear weapons don't always do, is we do produce policy documents. So we have an NPR, we have an NSS. Now, until the current administration writes their NPR, which I wouldn't anticipate that NPR coming out till next year at the earliest, that administration should already be implementing their NSS. So we have the previous administrations as guidance. This president has not come out and said anything that is that would counter what the previous administration has said in their NSS in terms of policy. Now, he's made some speeches. What I would say is, what I would tell the allies is I would hope that the next NPR, the one thing we have with the Trump administration is we know what their first NPR looked like. So we do have an idea of what their second, hopefully what their second NPR would look like. In that first NPR, the Trump administration said, no nation should doubt our commitment to our partners and allies when it comes to extended deterrence. That was in the first Trump NPR. I would think that a similar type statement would be in the next NPR. I know that we have, there's a lot of things in the press right now about NATO, about tariffs, et cetera. We also have to remember, look at what the U.S. has done. Look at the actions. Sometimes they speak louder than the words. So a couple of weeks ago, we had a B-52 drop JDAMs in Finland, 60 miles from where Russian troops are. There's nothing that Senator Rubio has said, that would detract from, or Secretary of State Rubio former Senator Rubio has said that would detract from, our commitments to our allies and partners. The Trump administration is not the first administration to mention a shift to the Pacific. Obama talked about a shift to the Pacific. So, the idea of a shift to the Pacific, or that's where the main threat is, I think is a somewhat of a thread through previous administrations.
Yeah, that's a good kind of turning point, is this movement to the Pacific and the need for extended nuclear deterrence here in the Pacific as well. So, I mean, China is definitely building up their nuclear stockpile and their ability to deliver that stockpile. There's questions in Japan and South Korea about, the continued viability of the extended nuclear deterrence. And, some people have mentioned, building their own nuclear stockpiles in those countries. I think Australia, here we've been a little bit quieter about, this idea of, do we need nuclear deterrence and extended nuclear deterrence? It is a thought, but hasn't been expressed as loudly. So have you seen any look at, the Pacific and extended nuclear deterrence in your role and, students examining that and questions on that area?
Well, this is what I would say. We know going back to the 2010 that the TLAM-N going away was of concern to our allies in 2010 NPR. How do you assure allies? So one of the ways I would say is, and this represents whether you call it a three-body problem or you call it a more complex problem to solve. The idea is we used to have a continuous bomber presence on Guam. That was something that you could look at and say, see, we're there. We're always going to be in the Pacific. However, what I would say is that the world that we live in with the dynamics between Russia and China and the United States And even I think General Cotton talks about it's not just a two problem, not a three-bodied problem with two adversaries, but it's a two plus one, right? So you throw in North Korea, you throw in Iran. We have it's a very complex strategic environment. Only to say this is why we have, we've gone from a continuous bomber presence to a bomber task force concept. The idea being that if I need bombers in the Middle East to cover the withdrawal from Afghanistan, if I need B-1s in Norway for the first time ever when there are discussions going on with NATO over Sweden and Finland, right? So if I want to put B-1s in Norway, again, or something's going on in the Pacific, then I need that, right? So anyway, only to say, right, that this is one of the concepts that we've had to move to, which is in order to assure our allies of that. Slick command is another thing. Under the first Trump administration, we did deploy the 76-2 at the unclassified level. We know it's out there. It's operational. It's a low-yield, fast response option. But it's technically, right, the U.S. is still following New START. So it's New START limited. Slick command would be deployed on systems that are not New START limited. And so this is a way, I would say, to assure our allies. Again, yes, we say certain things in documents, but then also I would say allies want to say, okay, show me your palm line. What are you buying? What are you spending money on? LRSO, or Slick command. These are programs that I think allies can look at and say, those are there to assure us from an extended deterrence perspective. And those, now that's my view, but that's what I would say is we do want to assure our allies. What Senator Rubio said, even when he was talking about Ukraine and the possibility of a peace settlement that would include nuclear weapons in Ukraine, what Secretary Rubio said is, we do not want to add another nuclear nation under this administration. And I think if you look at it, one is that proliferation. We don't want another country to gain a nuclear weapons capability or even expanding DCA. So expanding DCA proliferating? So it depends on how you define proliferation, but that's what I would say is not trying to expand the number of host nations, but definitely increase the amount, maybe, right? I think all of our European allies are buying the F-35, and I won't say who said it while we were over in Europe, but it's like, thank you, Mr. Putin, because you've just sold all of our allies F-35s. And that's right. They want that capability.
Mel, thank you so much. This is fascinating. We're in a really interesting situation here in the Asia Pacific, and there's a lot of talk in Australia about us being kind of in the pre-mobilization era with regards to potential conflict with China. I'm really interested in your thoughts about, because like issues with extended deterrence, missile defense, it's the you know, the concepts and the theories that we've developed really kind of Eurocentric. I'm curious if you have thoughts, perspectives on the extent to which the issues in the Asia Pacific, which is very different geographically and logistically, if they have a special flavor in the Asia Pacific, concepts like, you know, deterrence, extended deterrence, second strike, MAD, etc. Sorry, big question.
This is what I would say, right? You mentioned in the intro my flight for Operation Enduring Freedom. Every time we go to Europe, from whether I was in the military flying B-52s or even when we go with the students, you get on a plane in Atlanta and 8-9 hours later, you're getting off a plane in London or in Paris. That is not the case with the Pacific. I literally took off from Missouri and because of operational requirements, flew west for 24 hours. And that was over the entire Pacific Ocean. It takes 24 hours to fly over the entire Pacific Ocean. It is a vast space, and it doesn't have a lot of places to land aircraft at or to stage out of. So this is one of the challenges with that environment. The first thing I would say is we talk about, right? We hear people in the press talk about a fight with China, and what we want is what the Secretary of Defense said. The Secretary of Defense, previous Secretary of Defense, every Secretary of Defense, what we want is to deter conflict first. We don't want to sit there and say, we're going to fight China. We want to deter. And so how do you do that? One, by showing that the cost of action is worse than the benefit of whatever perceived action you think you might get. I think there are concerns out there about, obviously, China is growing in their nuclear capability. So the previous administration said that if you want to go down this road, we will go down the prevailing strategy route, which is really which was the Reagan route. The idea that if you really want to go down this route, if you really want to go down the arms buildup route, we, the United States, can do that. We can produce Slick-O-Man. We can produce other munitions similar to the types that were created in the Cold War. For every nuclear capability, for every conventional capability, we had a nuclear capability. I think at least the allies want to see that we are exploring systems that would help assure them more than, does an SLBM on a submarine you can't see, or an ICBM in a hole that's somewhere in Montana, does that assure the allies as much as knowing there is a cruiser or an attack sub somewhere with Slick-O-Man on it? Does that assure the allies more? Or does F-35s, right, parked on your soil, assure the allies more? I think that's one of the things that we have to do when it comes to that AOR. Obviously, China has a very robust missile capability. This is why we're looking, right? We're looking at multiple places. How do you deter that? You have to complicate their targeting strategy. You have to complicate where they can hit us. And again, in the Pacific, there's just so much vastness and not very many places to stage out of.
So in bombers, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, credibility and dropping JDAMs off of Finland to provide, you know, some assurance. What is their role here in the Pacific to help, you know, ensure deterrence and provide credibility to that, you know, nuclear deterrence for, you know, nations here? How can the United States improve that with the use of bombers?
So I think one of the things that we have recently done is, one, we have to understand the bombers are an ICBM in Montana, you know, it's there. It is the fastest responsive leg of the triad. The SLBMs, the subs, are the stealthy second strike capability. The bombers are the visible sign of American deterrence. We will bring them to wherever deterrence is needed. One of the things I would say is recently, right, we have had bombers deploy or at least, right, go into Australia as a sign of assurance to our allies. I've flown personally over South Korea several times to assure our allies. So that is a credible sign of American deterrence. I flew the B-2, I flew the B-2. I love the technology of the B-2. I'll never get to fly a B-21, but I think technology is fabulous. That being said, there's something about the B-52 that still, right, causes your allies to and your adversaries to take notice. Otherwise, why would we be extending this thing for another 25 years? It should give you pause when you think about the fact that the last B-52 pilot still has not been born. That's that tells you how long the B-52 will be around. So I think that's the idea is the bomber, and because of the vastness of, again, the Pacific Ocean, you need bombers because they have the legs to get into the fight. And that's what, right, that's the credibility part of it is, and the messaging part. So whenever there's a tricky situation or you want to send a signal, this is why you do it with the visible force of a bomber, because it just, they are strategic assets, and it's very much a, we are only going to send them when we want to send a strong message.
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of Australia, and how we become a better partner in terms of deterrence, because extended nuclear deterrence is not just the U.S., right? It's there's a role for the allies. What does the ideal ally do to help ensure that deterrence holds?
I will say that I heard this guy on TV the other day say that, right, if one person is speaking, it's not a discussion. So I think the idea is there has to be a discussion. We do this with our Japanese allies. We have these bilateral TTXs, tabletop exercises. It's a way to kind of say, okay, in this situation, this is what you can expect the U.S. to do. We want, and I think it would be on our allies would want to say, what are you, the U.S., going to do in this situation? What can we expect from you in this situation to bring to the table? And what can we do to help you, right, in this situation? Whether it's pre-positioning equipment for future operations, being part of the discussion. Now, I will say, we know this from the last administration's NPR. The allies got a vote. That there was some concern over no first use, sole purpose policies. The allies made their voices heard because it's like, if you're the provider of extended deterrence, then you have to listen to what the allies are saying are their concerns. And so this is why you saw in the previous administration something along the lines of, right, extreme circumstances, because of the idea that the allies did not want the U.S. to go down a sole purpose or no first use type policy. And I think in the first Trump administration, again, it was a little more descriptive about threshold decisions and what would trigger threshold decisions. I don't know if that's where the second Trump administration will go with their NPR. But I think that's the idea, is the allies want to be heard about their concerns over policy and even programs. Again, I think you all know Vipin Narang. His first book on regional nuclear strategies, it was very good in the intro that he talks about the idea of what is nuclear posture. Is nuclear posture what I write about and what I say and my doctrine, or is nuclear policy posture really about my programs, my training, et cetera? And again, combination of both. But I would also say, look at what the U.S. is funding and training and putting out, because that should assure our allies, I would think, more or just as much as what we put on paper. I think Slickerman is a, you had two outgoing generals before the Congress talk about the need for Slickerman. The HASC and the SASC put Slickerman into the budget. It is a sign to our allies that we hear you about you wanting more assurance, and this is a sign of how we can give it to you.
That's a great review of what's happening here in the Pacific and how extended deterrence is being thought about. And it's systems, it's dialogues, sometimes it's a united front against our adversaries here. So a great review. I'd like to thank you, Mel, for joining us today. It was a great review of what's happening in the School of Advanced Nuclear Deterrence Studies. We're going to keep our eyes open for all those theses coming out and the papers that are associated with that and the great stuff that's happening there. And really appreciate you joining the podcast today and putting up with our technical issues. So thanks a bunch for that.
Jammed by the Chinese, right? No.
Yeah, someone may be dragging cables nearby. So thanks a bunch, Mel. Thanks to our listeners. And I just want to remind everyone to always think deterrence. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Deterrence Down Under. Please take a minute to review the podcast, as your reviews help our podcast reach more listeners and expand the debate about strategic issues facing Australia and the region. Our show is made possible by the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization that relies upon donations to produce this podcast and spread awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can find a wide range of NIDS podcasts at thinkdeterrence.com. If you have any questions or feedback, feel free to send us an email at ddu@thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, and our sponsors, and all the amazing members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible.